So I'm going to talk, as you see, about... Oh, did somebody put this on?
I did.
Oh. Oh, very good. Thank you. I am not going to be showing slides. I hope you can survive a lecture without slides, which is... I do often show slides, by the way. I'm not against slides at all. So what I want to emphasize is something that I think has been sort of not quite understood, and that is this notion of intermediation. And I've been doing quite a bit of work also since then. But the question for me is, what is it that really changes in a city like New York, in a city like London, in a city like Tokyo? Those were the three cities that I wound up working on. When the global, and I say it in quotation marks, because we have all long been international. So the language of the global is very frequently in many settings, and I am one of those who uses it to mark a difference with what are ultimately very long and old histories of internationalisms, of a whole variety. So some people think that when one uses globalization, it means that that's when it all starts. No, we have had internationalisms of all sorts, and I'm one of those who's very keen on emphasizing that, because then it also means that it raises the question, so what is different in the so-called global era? And I also use that language. But you know, I say it in quotation marks because again, it is a kind of a statement that emerges, you know, with full force, but global is in itself also a rather neutral term. So when I use my quotation marks, it means sort of global economy, global politics, but especially global economy. And for me, a critical moment that I don't think everybody who is engaged by the subject necessarily looks at it that way, by the way. I'm just talking about how I sort of moved into the subject. I think that the 1980s marks a difference. A difference that was building up. By the 1980s, privatization, globalization in quotation marks, and in my reading, intermediation, are critical elements. And for me, the critical element is intermediation when it comes to the global city. Not vis-a-vis everything, but vis-a-vis this notion of a certain type of city, a certain type also of systematicity. Now, I haven't read what he wrote here. So, oh, you took it from my text. Oh, so we're fine, I think, right? I cannot stand here, give my back to the audience, and read what you wrote.
Your picture. Did you like it better?
Oh, no, keep that on. That's good. No. Okay. I like letters. Yeah, better that than my face. Otherwise, they see me twice. Oh, there is a photo. For those of you who want to look at my face, there it is. Very good. So one issue, as I was saying, that has not quite been well understood, I think, generally, is this question of why cities, very concrete spaces, concrete in many different meanings of that term, right? A lot of concrete also, why they become such significant actors. Now, many of you are very young here, including you, too young to know that in the 1980s, in the late 1970s, but in the 1980s, the whole question of the rise of the digital led to a vast number of books, of assertions, of policies, etc., that basically, whether explicitly or implicitly, contained within them the notion that any major firm, any major economic actor that can afford the digital does not need a city. The opposite happened. Cities became even more important. In the late 1970s, something we forget, cities were mostly broke. New York was officially bankrupt. Officially, New York always number one, you know, Number one, officially bankrupt. London was poor. I think Tokyo was quite poor too. Tokyo maybe never was poor. You are so well organized here that you never managed to be poor. But many major cities were poorish. You know, poor is too big a language, but New York City went officially bankrupt, as you know. Paris was poor, London was poor. Yes, there were grand buildings, there was wealth, etc. But the larger notion of the city as a complex system, complex but incomplete, a lot of poor cities. Why? Because the major actors at that point had been the building of infrastructures, you know, nationwide, in France, in the UK, in a whole bunch of countries. The move to the suburbs. And cities where, certainly if you take a city like New York, which is probably an extreme case, you had a lot of poverty, was left behind, you know, the middle classes moved out, many of them. The upper classes were always there, that 1% that has long been with us. But a lot of, most of the population of cities actually winds up living in suburbs. Some close by to the city, some not so close by. So I arrive in New York at that time, just a personal moment here. And being a foreigner, I grew up in Latin America, etc. I, just walking through New York, I picked up on stuff. I don't mean picking up stuff, but I picked up on stuff. You know, I sort of got a sense that something was brewing that was not visible. And I remember going to talk with experts, you know, experts on the city, and they would all basically say, these cities are finished as significant actors in major economic sectors because of the digital. There was a lot of that kind of talk. And I sort of, I took it seriously, etc. But I had been doing a research project with immigrants, and they were mostly Latinos, and one of this group of immigrants, which were they were Dominicanos, were the main cleaners on Wall Street. I don't know if you can see where I'm going, and so I was often had been at some of these conferences, and I remember my first move. Remember, I was a newcomer. I was truly out of it. Huh? So I remember going up to this group of men planners, male planners in New York City, and approaching them very politely and saying, could I just ask you a question? I was totally the foreigner. I was totally not a New Yorker. And I was short and they were very tall. And so I was looking up at them and they looked at me like saying, who are you? Now this goes back, men do not conduct themselves like this anymore, huh? Mostly. So I asked them, what's happening in New York? It seems that something is happening in Wall Street, etc. And they looked at me like, who is this person? And at the same sort of thing, they started all laughing. They just found it terribly comic. And I looked at them and I said, well, would you help me get onto Wall Street? I would like to interview some people on Wall Street. And then they looked at me even with bigger eyes, and they started laughing, and they said, look, Wall Street is ours. You can go to Wall Street at night. At night, Wall Street was basically dead. Yes, there were some computers humming, but this was not a live scene. And I had been doing this work with the cleaners of Wall Street, so I said, that's right, I'm going to go at night when the cleaners are there. So I called up my Dominican friend, and I said, listen, can we have lunch? Lunch is at midnight for the cleaners on Wall Street. And they say, yeah, come by. Now, the cleaners, and I chose the cleaners who were in this one of these huge buildings, I mean, vast buildings, that were, you know, that were had sort of very traditional, routinized types of activities in them. Now, I should say, as a footnote, that a lot of the enterprises, as I already mentioned, were leaving New York City. They didn't have to be in New York. And certainly if you were a traditional insurance company, et cetera, between the digital and, you know, you just didn't need to be to have an office, frankly, in New York City. So this is a very important fact. So I go at midnight with my sandwich. I carry my sandwich. And Wall Street was absolutely not the domain, as I said, for real sort of, you know, the high-level staff. It was just closed, basically. It was empty, but the cleaners were there. And so I go at midnight, and we had lunch, because that's how they call it, the cleaners. You know, you have lunch at midnight. And so we're eating our sandwiches, and I say, but for whom are you cleaning? And the capo, you know, the top cleaner, says, come, I'll show you. And he showed me. Now, the cleaners, you understand, the cleaners get it into every office, but they have very strict rules. So there's no, you know. But he showed me, he said, look at this. Look at this office. Look at this office. Look at that office. You know, we walked around this huge building, and they were like boutique things, very, very fancy. And he tells me, I have counted 70 nationalities. So very international. 70 is a lot, by the way. Huh? Now, again, I want to just make this setting, right? So that the notion in New York City was New York City is finished when it comes to high-level businesses. The big corporations, and New York, by the way, was an extreme case, because with milder versions, this was happening in London and was happening in other major cities. But a lot of the big firms left. This happened in New York, this happened in Chicago, this happened. They didn't need to be in the city. So they moved to areas where they felt safer. New York City was not only broke, there was a lot of criminality. The police couldn't manage. So I want to have, I invite you to have that scenario in mind. So in that setting, the newspapers, for instance, only published information about all the firms that were leaving. No newspaper at that point had published what these cleaners showed me. There's a whole new set of small but very, very high level firms were installing themselves in these old Wall Street buildings. From the outside, you couldn't see that. You know, these are like, they're massive buildings and there's no transparency there. Now, so he shows me all of this. And I had sort of been speculating a bit, you know, something is happening. And I knew it from my friends from overseas. I had not had access to this space in Wall Street. And it turns out that that is the beginning of a whole set of intermediary actors. These were specialized service firms, but very high level. Lawyers, people who were innovators who said, this is worthwhile exploring, et cetera, et cetera. So that was my first step into this world, even though I had had a bit of an inkling for other reasons, into this world of an emergent global city. So for me, in its narrowest definition, which is not usually the definition used, you know, in general conversations or in many of the articles that have been written about it, but for me, the basic definition was that intermediation was what was happening. The big corporations, they didn't need to be in New York. But once they start going global, and by 1980, a lot of these firms are beginning to go global. And clearly, there were foreign firms locating in New York. And so what they really needed was a kind of specialized information about, does it make sense for me to close this operation and to invest money or to buy or to deal with people in Argentina, in Mongolia, in France, whatever it was. But that is really the emergence, if you want, of this global digital age that, while it was very digital, needed a specific location. And the same thing was happening, though, in a softer way, in a less pronounced way, in London. Now, at that point, phase number two, I sort of was trying to understand what this really all meant. And I decided to develop a methodology. And the methodology did not start with cities. It started with a whole range of economic activities. And I was particularly interested in these, what I call these intermediaries. In other words, not the big corporation, but all the specialized service firms that the big corporation needs if it wants to operate globally, right? And so this intermediate sector is a sector where the big corporates can buy 27 hours of Mongolian accounting, 51 hours of Argentinian preference for investments, et cetera, et cetera. Now, if you consider that, at least many of the American firms, when they went global, we had battalions of those firms. Those were not just two or three firms. There were many firms. And these firms needed access to this type of information. So, I repeat, in its narrowest definition, the global city function is an intermediary function. It is not the big corporations. The big corporations didn't need to be in cities. They still really don't need to be in cities. But what they need is access to an extraordinary mix of highly specialized sectors that can deliver all the goods. Now, Goldman Sachs, for instance, was one of those. It was a much smaller firm than it is today, and it really served to serve the corporates. It was not a traditional bank, nor was it quite what it is today, which is a major financial actor that has its own, you know, innovations, has been taken to court 10 times just in the last few years, as people probably know. They're very experimental. They are risking, you know, not respecting the law, et cetera, et cetera. But the point here that I want to capture is very innovative. Exploring. We can do that. We can do that. I mean, this was a very, very live animal at that point. Now, what struck me then was, and the image that I had, was that here were these cities. Again, I repeat, New York City was broke. London was poor. You know, many cities were poor. And the image that I had was some sort of like a huge platform with multiple times of highly specialized firms installing itself in these cities. So it starts out fairly small. Many people don't notice it. But before you knew it, they were occupying a massive part of central Manhattan. Well, central and lower, et cetera, right? These two axes that there are. And it kept growing. As it kept growing, it expelled the middle classes, all kinds of smaller firms. So it was a very marked event. It really marked a difference. It changed those cities. Now back to this sort of this platform. That was a zone of a rapidly growing set of very internationalized firms, a lot of foreign experts on all kinds of things. It kept developing. It kept growing. It invented all kinds of novel, you know, instruments, what we could do, et cetera, et cetera. So that, to me, is then the global city function in its narrowest sense. It's about intermediation. You know what I mean by intermediation? In other words, it's not two parties buying and selling to each other. It's one, the corporates, who need expertise on all kinds of aspects because they are going to be working in 25 countries, in, you know, whatever, it could be more. And they, that intermediate sector, provides the expertise. They, in other words, never lose. What they may advise, what they may produce in terms of legal options or whatever it might be to the corporations, you know, it may go well or it may go bad, but they deliver the goods, they get their money, and they're out of it, so to say, out of there. But the corporations, it didn't always work very well for them. As you know, the most familiar case is the mergers and acquisitions, right? A lot of those mergers and acquisitions, which were organized by that intermediate sector, these were very, very complex negotiations. They didn't work out. There were a lot of more traditional firms that lost out. But the intermediary sector kept gaining. Now, third type of element in this story. When you have a very live, rapidly expanding seen as really delivering the goods. In other words, many, many are asking for those services. This kind of intermediate sector, it begins to expand rather quickly. It begins to take over many spaces in the city. It pushes out a lot of the lower income workers, the nurses, the teachers, the firemen, the, you know, all of those people that you want them close by, the policemen, etc. The city has to start charging the citizens extra charges in order to cover the added expenses. The cities have trouble producing the money because it's rapidly expanding, totally different with fancy buildings where once you had maybe 15 families, now you had maybe 3 very fancy families. So you get the image, right? Now again, New York is an extreme case, but this was happening in many cities. This was not just in New York. Now, at that point, what you begin to see is a rapid growth of a new type of very wealthy actor. And I always say, you know, when people insist on the importance of the 1%, the 1% super rich, right? That is the phrase. The 1% has long existed. We've always had a 1%. And they often did very nice things like public libraries. You know what I'm talking about, right, girl? The difference that's the beginning of the global era marks is the 30%, up to 40%, who are far richer than they ever thought they would be, who enter the city. They are very young, very smart, and this sector keeps growing, you know, as the big corporates begin to move into more and more countries. They need more and more specialized services, more and more advice. And that is that intermediate sector that cannot lose. It delivers the goods, it gets paid, it becomes bigger and bigger and richer, et cetera, et cetera. But it also occupies a lot of the city, beginning to generate that condition which we now see so much. That is that lower income people can no longer afford to live in central areas of the city. They're getting pushed out. And that is a story that begins at that point. Because before that, in fact, the city was underoccupied. A city like New York was underoccupied. It was not a desirable place, except if you were very rich, you know, and existed in a sort of bubble, and much of the time you were not there anyhow. You were in your yacht, who knows where, you know, all of that kind of stuff. So this is, to me, a critical transformation of the urban condition. Now, I don't know where this is at, by the way. This is just one page, right? Or is it more pages? Yeah. So we can keep that there. Now, it seems to me that intermediary sector, and again, I want to repeat, the image for me is this vast operational capability that installs itself in these cities. And it delivers, and they're continuously rotating, going to other countries, new countries join the club, so you need more expertise, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very live, state-of-the-art, extremely highly paid. They are not the 1%, but that 30 to 40% is very rich. In other words, massive displacement of your regular accountants, your regular lawyers, your professors, you know, they who had been living in parts of Manhattan, parts of London, you know, that are quite central, out. So this really marks a critical transformation in these major cities. New York, I think, was the extreme case, but it also happens in other cities. Now, today, we have a third element that enters the picture, or maybe it's my fourth element here. And this is something that, again, it involves a material condition, but the material condition doesn't quite give you the full story. And this is about the financializing of all kinds of materialities. Buildings are one key, and that is what I want to talk about. So, by now, we have a situation where traditional banking is something, but the real actor doesn't have anything to do with traditional banking. It really is high finance. It's algorithmic mathematics. It's another world. And I would say that a lot of the microeconomists, most economists in the United States who say or teach in universities, are microeconomists, which is a very fancy form of knowledge with many very complex formulas, etc. But it doesn't quite explain some of these transformations that I'm talking about. So Goldman Sachs, famous, this is just one of many firms. It's just a very famous one, so I mention it. Goldman Sachs used to have a space that was called the back room, where you had 100 secretaries. Well, about probably 10 years ago, it started to change, and by now it's 100 physicists. And I am not criticizing the physicists. But this is the rise of really of algorithmic mathematics, which marks high finance. And it means that high finance is completely different from traditional banking. It has nothing to do with traditional banking. What does this algorithmic mathematics allow you to do? It allows you to transform, and I give you very concrete examples. This is something I'm doing research about now. So a building, materiality, we can see it, you know, can't miss it, subjected to algorithmic mathematics. That building is no longer the real thing. It stands there as building, but the action is 10, 15 steps further, algorithmic math, and it is functioning as an asset. So we on the street see the building, but the action is not that building. The action, that building has been transformed into, if you want, a field of material assets. Why? Because the high investment circuit got tired of derivatives several years ago and said, no more derivatives for me. The derivatives can go to the teachers, the policemen, the schools. Not for me. Asset-backed securities. Now, I want to very quickly insert just a clarification just to make sure that we're all on the same page. The issue here is that with this algorithmic mathematics, you can really transform in an invisible way a condition that is marked by materiality. I just want you to keep that in mind because this is quite extraordinary. This is admirable form of knowledge. And again, the physicists really are not to blame for what I'm going to say next. They are these brilliant minds that were able to make these transformations. A buddy of mine showed me quite a bit of the stuff, you know, how this stuff happens. Now, so just to make it very concrete, right now in New York City, if you go to certain parts of Manhattan, chic and elegant parts of Manhattan, you see luxury towers. This is just one example. Luxury towers that are basically empty. The notion is, ooh, poor investors. It's not working out. They are not renting it out. They are not selling those units. No. Actually, something else is happening. When I understood that this was happening, I couldn't believe it, frankly. But anyhow, the building, by algorithmic math, I repeat now what I said earlier, but I wanted to give you the details. By algorithmic math, is transformed into a field what is really the objective here, physical, material assets. So the investor buys that kind of stuff. And it doesn't represent a building. It just is, the building is a factor in there. I hope that people are following this because this stuff is amazing. The building is a factor, but what is really being bought, what is being transacted, is a very fancy instrument that represents something material, that represents an asset, sort of in the conventional sense of that word. The result, and here I just want to bring in sort of some of the theoretical issues that I have long been interested in, which is, what does the material, the material, what does it tell us? And it can tell us quite a bit, but under these conditions, it is telling us very little. You see the building, you assume the building is the site of that produces the profit, but it doesn't. The profits are out here in a very complex form of algorithmic mathematical instruments, etc. We only see the building. We think, oh, poor owners of these buildings, it didn't work out. No. It actually, it's great. Because the high demand, high investment circuit, asset-backed securities, they get that. They are happy. The bankers are happy. The building stands there empty. It is working 100%. Because you can buy, sell these instruments, you know, several times in a day. So now for me as an urbanist, for instance, the urbanist in me, I think this is really pretty bad for cities. It might be great for the investors. It might be bad for also other sectors. But the notion that the material, the building, loses its capacity to have speech, you know, speech in the substantive sense of that term, to me it's actually quite alarming. There are a whole set of other negative features, you know, that are hanging in there, but the critical image that I would like to leave you with, and I probably should have brought some of those slides, are these very fancy, this is Manhattan, the same thing is happening in Paris, the same thing is happening in London, in Milano, you know, we keep discovering other cities where this is happening. So I repeat, the building is transformed by algorithmic mathematics, and it functions as, if you want, a source of all kinds of asset-backed securities, real assets. And but in the meantime, the building stands empty. And at night, it is not, you know, just from the urban point of view, it's not great. The instrumentalities that make this possible are amazing. I mean, you really stand in awe to this algorithmic mathematics, what you can do with it. Now, let's remember that a five-year-old can construct an algorithm, right? I mean, because it's an open function. But these algorithms are very, very complex. And again, the other thing that I want to emphasize, the derivative, we the people are stuck with the derivatives. The derivatives have a long history by now. They had been declared illegal, but in the late 1970s, it starts in Chicago, they were once again declared, okay, we can work with this. Now, we have now, I don't know if people have seen that. Let me just give you an example. A few months ago, the same day, the same hour, 14 municipal governments in Italy went broke. Now, we have a lot of such stories in the United States. But this is the simplest example, so I use it. Those municipal governments thought that they had made a loan. No. They thought they had made a loan. But it wasn't a loan. It was a derivative. And the derivatives have had a long, successful life, decades. But now they have really lost a lot of capability because these chains are so long that, you know, you never know what's going to happen. The high investment circuit doesn't want them. We, the average, whatever, we are stuck with them. Municipal governments all over are stuck with them. I would be very curious to know whether, well, Japan is such a well-run country that you probably don't have this problem. But this is, these are micro histories that I find absolutely astounding. And so right now I would say that the question of the global city, when you look at the economics of it, is to me very problematic. And again, I want to say what I said when I started. this intermediate sector is the sector that is the real winner here. It's not necessarily the corporates. I mean, the high investment circuit, you know, they have very significant resources. That 30% of very high income workers that are making more money than they ever thought they would, which are connected to this whole development, they are doing very fine. And it really has meant that the middle classes are split into two. An impoverished middle class of nurses and firemen who have long trips, they can no longer afford to live in New York or in central London, etc., etc. And then some very, very rich, 30% in the case of a city like New York, that, you know, yes, a middle class, but so rich that they're not the richest of the richest, but they're very rich. So this is a profound transformation. And so one issue for me that hangs in there is this question of how do complex systems change? And they don't change by changing everything. They often change by just recombining, repositioning very limited instrumentalities, but that is enough to mark a massive transformation. Now, when I was in New York, back to that early moment, I loved the city. It was poor. It was broke. It was full of artists from all over the world. They were there because it was so cheap and because you had all these other artists. I became myself a performance artist, though I was an assistant professor. You know, assistant professors are in a delicate position. You have to work very hard, publish, etc. But there was this world. You know, I stepped out, I lived in Lower Manhattan. I was alone. You stepped out and you had this world of artists from all over the world. There were events. So I became a performance artist. I did voice, I did all kinds of things. And during the day I had my teaching job, you know, as a prof at a university. So it was hard work. But it was a magical moment for the city. And the irony was that city that was then poor, which meant that all these different groups of people could come, becomes very rich, and it really transforms. When we add to that these towers that are standing there, empty, and the fact that those empty towers, you know, these huge constructions I'm talking about, dark at night, very dark, and that these are really delivering the goods, are making a lot of money for those who own, you know, this is not one owner, these are, they own shares in all of that, etc. That is, to me, very alarming. That sort of deurbanizes the city. Now, I want to end on a few sort of comments. You know, I don't have a good sense of time, I confess. It's about time? Yeah, okay. So right now, you have probably about 40 global cities around the world. I do think that some are extreme, and what I described for Manhattan is one example of extreme. It has internationalized a lot of situations, modalities, etc. That intermediate sector is the queen of the domain. There is no doubt about that. That's the dominant sector. They rarely lose because they intermediate. So this has, now I want to sort of go on a somewhat abstract thing. The question of how do complex systems change, the question where I started with. So these cases that I have described show us that complex systems change, not in today's world, not necessarily by changing everything, but very often simply by shifting capabilities that in time one were embedded in certain modalities, they're shifted to another modality. So a lot of what eventually becomes high finance, as distinct from traditional banking, it starts with traditional banking. But it takes a trip. It doesn't change everything, but it takes a trip that changes enough that it becomes a different instrumentality. What I have described to you here, the financializing, this financializing mode, with algorithmic math and all of that, that is an extreme, very brilliant minds. I mean, it really is admirable as capability. The results, I think, are very negative for cities. I am not a fan of that kind of stuff. And to me, the city matters because the city, again, just to give it a definition, I like to describe the X through a non-X. So I cannot say that the city is the city. So the city is a complex but incomplete system. It's very complex and it's very incomplete. And because of that, it can keep on living. It has long lives. Cities have very long lives. If you think about it historically, cities have outlived all kinds of far more powerful but formalized closed systems. Kingdoms, whatever, you know, just mention it. Maybe in some countries, like in the United States, you don't have old histories, but in many countries you have very old histories. And so there's something about urban space, because what survives, in a way, is something that has to do with urban space. And it's the urban space of the rich, which, you know, built a lot of the great buildings across the centuries, and it's the urban space of the poor. Those are the two spaces that have actually outlived multiple historical periods. That, to me, is interesting, the fact that it's also the spaces of the poor that have outlived. And today, if I may sort of diverge a bit from this particular set of explanations that I've given, today, a lot of the land that we think is available for, say, poor communities to inhabit, like in Africa or in Latin America, etc., it's all owned. There are about 30 government foreign countries, the governments of foreign countries, that are buying up vast pieces of land in parts of Asia, Latin America, and Africa, and the poor. Well, not the poor. I mean, the small farmers, the little, you know, the ones who know how to keep the land alive, etc. Smallholders, we call them usually. They are being pushed out of the land. This is a major, major history. So when we look, and I want to get back to cities, that's why I'm mentioning it. When we look through a satellite image, we see a lot of emptiness, green, whatever, in Africa, parts of Latin America, and parts of Asia. In fact, it's all owned. About 30 major governments and 150 major corporations own vast stretches of land in several parts of the world that are not their own country. So where do the displaced smallholders, the poorer, you know, residents of rural areas, where do they go? They go to cities. And I wish I had brought an image. I have an image that shows massive concentrations of very high sort of luxury buildings. And then these vast, what in Latin America we call la periferia, these vast peripheral zones that are mixed. You know, some of it is irregular housing, some of it is regular housing. You know, it's sort of a mix. More and more people are living in urbanized areas or in these irregular, as they call, not fully formalized, you know, peripheral areas. Not because they love cities. People, the urbanists think, oh, they want to come to the city. No. Those urbanized areas are one of the few areas where they can go to. Because most of the land is now taken. The big mining, the corporates that are doing, you know, the agriculture, raising cattle, et cetera, many, many different things. So, and water, of course. The Coca-Colas, the Nestle's, and 25 other major bottlers. So coming back to the city and the global city, the city is one of the spaces today where the expelled, where those without power, get to make a history, they get to make an economy, they get to make a culture. So the city really matters. It matters because so much of the rural land is no longer, either it's dead, it's been mined. It has, you know, big sort of what do we call them, plantations happening there, etc. So one space where the poor, the lower income people, the modest income, not just the poor, you know, but a whole set of sort of not the rich, get to make a history, get to make a culture, get to make a local economy is in cities. This has now become an extreme condition. Until not too long ago, the notion was that you had many options. There were the rural areas, there was this, there was all of that. Now it really is the city. So the city is also the space where the new frontier is. The historic frontier that we have known, sort of the edges of empire, where there was an encounter between members from very, very different worlds, an encounter that could be pacific or very aggressive, clearly, huh? That it just doesn't exist anymore. Even if the satellite shows you still a lot of green and empty land. No, because it's owned by, again, by the mining corporations, by the plantation people. And so, you know, the city actually today is one strategic space, both for the most advanced sectors, high finance and sort of all the cousins that are in the specialized of the law, et cetera, that are needed by corporations to operate globally. And it's also one of the spaces where those without power still get to make a history, a little economy, you know, their neighborhood economy. So in my reading, the city sort of becomes this very interesting space. I'm concluding the global city. I want to keep that term to mark a mix. It's not just about the corporate part that really engendered this kind of global city, but it is also about people, about low-income people. I think it's the middle classes, the old-fashioned middle classes. They are sort of out. They live in modest suburbs. The rich middle classes, the new rich middle classes, very much in the city. And then the poor in cities, not necessarily in the best parts of the cities. So the city is quite an interesting space in many ways in today's world, you know. And I think, so one way of putting it is that a far deeper transformation has happened than we tend to realize and we tend to recognize. You know, this is really a profound transformation. I go back to this notion, you know, how do complex systems change? They do not change, and I mean foundational change. They do not change by changing everything. They change by changing a few things that then make quite a difference. And I think that is where we are at now. So the city is both, I think in many ways, the site for extreme forms of power that are marked by a kind of indifference to a general well-being, to the older sort of modest middle classes that after all are the tissue of a city in many ways, not the super rich, not the super poor, but that broad middle class. That middle class has divided. And so to me there is a kind of a need to engage in particular kinds of practices, like one of my projects now in Manhattan especially is the notion of relocalizing what we can relocalize. So my rhetorical question is, do I really need a multinational to have a cup of coffee in my neighborhood? No. And why then should I not do that? Because every franchise, like Starbucks or whatever, extracts a bit of value from that particular site. Any franchise is going to be extractive. And so this rise of extractive logics is one of the big negatives, I would say, in the current period. So the traditional bank was commerce. The financial transactions that I've been describing is not commerce. That's an extractive sector, is one way of putting it. And so there are many such examples. So again, if I need a computer, I need a franchise. Otherwise, I have to go to the factory. But for so many other things, we should begin to do it in situ. And that is what is happening. In Manhattan, this is quite visible, and in the rest of New York, too, that there's a real return to relocalizing what we can relocalize, which is not everything. And again, I repeat, because every franchise, we're now dominated by franchises, every franchise takes away, takes out some of the capacity of the local neighborhood to spend money and takes it to headquarters. Well, no, let it circulate, you know, and create a new type of urban economy that is made up of many, many localized urban economies that is inevitably going to be partial. But we cannot simply keep on with franchising. Now, I don't know how many people know, but the mayor of Barcelona is a major destination, as you know, for tourists. The mayor of Barcelona has said, no more franchises. And there was something else that she was also against. I can't remember what it is. But no more franchises. So the franchising phenomenon, you know what I'm talking about, right? When I say franchises, you know, the same major shops have shops all over the world in cities, etc. It really is, you know, everything is a curve in my book. So it starts out nice, interesting, it enables my life, etc. But eventually it truly becomes a negative in cities. So she has said, she's quite a radical person, Ada Colau, she has said, done with franchises. She can't eliminate the ones that are there, but she said no more. She also said no more Uber. I don't know how brilliant that is, because Uber is a very convenient, I must say, instrumentality. But so then ending now, the global city function is well and alive, number one. Number two, there are now many global cities in this narrow sense of the term, okay? And probably about 40 major. Number three, there are good things and there are bad things about the global city. And the critical vector, really, to make it good is not the super powerful actors like high finance, specialized high level services. They are making enormous amounts of money, but they're also destroying the options for middle income people to live in cities. But there are some good things happening. There is a lot of relocalizing happening in cities, and these are now modes of you know, being local in a big city that are connecting throughout the world. They exchange advice, how do we do this, how do we do that? That is quite a nice phenomenon. So the global city is there with its strengths and with its horrors. Thank you very much.